Welcome to College Land, the podcast featuring untold stories from higher education. I'm Nan Enstead in Madison, Wisconsin, which is originally the land of the Ho-Chunk people.
I'm Lisa Levenstein in Greensboro, North Carolina, a place that has long served as the site of meeting and exchange amongst a number of indigenous peoples, including the Kiowi and the Saura. Our podcast explores life inside our nation's colleges and universities and tracks some of the major changes that are happening.
We do this by sharing stories of the people who work there. So this week on campus, we are noticing the land acknowledgement statements that have become an expected part of events on many campuses. You sometimes also hear them at community events. And we opened our episode today with our own, though we have not done that before.
The purpose of land acknowledgement statements is to honor the land itself and to recognize the indigenous inhabitants who were the stewards of the land when colonial settlers expropriated it.
And it stems from a native practice. So when engaging in an event with another tribe or other tribes, a person who would be speaking would begin by acknowledging the tribal stewards of that territory. And as it's become practiced in universities, land acknowledgements can also function as sort of a consciousness-raising practice. It really invites people to recognize and reckon with the history of settler colonialism and indigenous dispossession.
But you know, land acknowledgements have become almost standard in some departments and programs, but many voice the criticism that it's just kind of become something to say and nothing substantial is changing. So they're asking, you know, what is the place of Native students on campus? Are they there in any significant numbers? Are their voices and needs being supported?
Yeah, I gotta say, I appreciate comedian Howie Echohawk's perspective. He wrote an article titled, Fuck Your Land Acknowledgement. And he's writing about land acknowledgements for community projects. And he writes, I live in liberal-ass Seattle, and I see these things all the time. They say, we acknowledge that we are on the unceded land of the Coast Salish people. And then they break ground on their Chipotle brand apartment buildings where you can live in a 500 square foot bean burrito for $1,750 a month.
Oh my gosh, those rents. And the hypocrisy in the midst of intense inequality. So how do we start taking some responsibility?
I do support land acknowledgements because I think they can be a wedge for demanding some more substantial change. They're not bad in themselves, and there are more respectful ways to do them.
You know, last month I heard a really wonderful one at UNC Charlotte, which was a tremendous history lesson in and of itself. And we'll link to that in the show notes. But you know, let's face it, the historic relationship between land-grant universities and tribes is more complex, really a lot more complex than what you can fit into a land acknowledgement, even the beautiful one that I heard the other day.
Last March, High Country News published a report by Tristan Aton and Robert Lee called Land Grab Universities that ended up going viral. And it's really challenging universities to take responsibility in a way that land acknowledgements do not. The Morrill Act of 1862 gave universities a bunch of land, like 11 million acres, mostly in the Midwest and West, and enabled them to sell it at a profit. And that profit became university endowments. So Tristan Aton and Robert Lee talk about how it's not just that universities are located on Indian land, but that universities were given thousands of acres of land that they could keep or lease or sell. And that kind of turned universities into real estate companies.
The land came from 160 land cessations made by almost 250 different tribes. And I think we all know that violence rather than choice was behind these land cessions. And that land wasn't necessarily anywhere near where the university was. So Cornell University, which is now private, gained the biggest grant of land. Cornell is in Ithaca, New York, but the land they gained was in Minnesota and Wisconsin and all through the West. So why is Cornell such an affluent school these days? This is a lot of why.
Yeah, Montana State, Iowa State, MIT, the University of Wisconsin, the University of Minnesota, Virginia Tech, University of Idaho, the University of Vermont, New Mexico State University, South Dakota State University. I could go on. In all, 52 universities netted $500 million when you adjust for inflation. So many of this nation's colleges and universities gained their first substantial endowment this way that it's not too much to say that Indian dispossession made U.S. higher education possible and accessible to the many white people, that is. So what's amazing about this article, and we're going to link to it in the show notes, is that Aton and Lee have got the data. They map the land that was granted to particular schools and what each school did with it and how much money they made from it. They also made this data public. So you can go on and you can look up your university or the university near you and figure it out. This has created conversations all over the country about what the true responsibility is for universities to redress these wrongs. So I interviewed Michael Dockery, a professor of forestry at the University of Minnesota and a Citizen Potawatomi member, about his work as a forester with the Menominee tribe in Wisconsin and what he thinks universities can do to improve relationships with tribes. Mike is also an associate faculty member of the American Indian Studies Department and an Institute on the Environment fellow at the University of Minnesota. So let's listen. I am really excited to be here today with Mike Dockery. Mike, welcome to CollegeLand.
Thank you for having me.
Mike, I'm so struck. You've worked as a forester in two really different college settings, the College of Menominee Nation and the University of Minnesota. And so I was hoping you would just start by telling us a little bit about your background and your story of doing forestry in these really different institutions.
Sure. My approach to forestry is really seeing myself as a servant, as someone that can help landowners or tribes in this case to achieve their land management goals or the goals they have for their forests. And that's very similar here at the university and when I was working with the College of Menominee Nation. I will say that I was working for the U.S. Forest Service at the time, and the Forest Service has a partnership with the College of Menominee Nation. And so I was there on their campus and leading up that partnership. And our goal with that was basically to make sure that forestry research, education, and outreach were, one, reflecting the views of Native people in the area, particularly the Menominee community. Two, that the Forest Service itself would be learning from the long, long history that the Menominee tribe has of managing their forests. In fact, they have the oldest sustainably managed forest in the United States. They started managing for timber. This is cutting trees and milling lumber in the 1850s. That was long before we had a U.S. Forest Service, long before people were talking about sustainable forestry and what that meant here in the United States. So really, for the agency and for me myself, learning from the Menominee was really, really amazing. But again, I see what I do as a public servant. And here at the University of Minnesota, it's no different. I work with tribal communities, try to understand their research needs, their questions, how they approach things like climate change, and then how we can work together to make sure that the forests are managed that way so that they have their long-term goals met.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this sustainable forest in the Menominee Nation. I think that's just a super compelling story that they've been managing their forests for such a long time. Can you talk a little bit about why that happened that way and, you know, how successful they've been?
Sure. I think for the Menominee people, like a lot of the tribes, as colonization was happening, as the United States government was signing treaties and tribes were ceding land, the tribes were looking for ways to stay within their traditional homelands, to maintain the ecosystems that have basically supported them for time immemorial. And so forestry was really a pretty attractive option. And the Menominee tribe really kind of grabbed onto that idea and went with it. Now, the United States government had a lot of ideas about making tribes into and Indian people into farmers. That was sort of the goal of the U.S. government, have land be ceded to the federal government and then have the tribes and individual tribal members become farmers. Well, the Menominee thought, well, we want to be foresters, essentially. And their leaders in the 1850s were basically saying, we think that we can use this forestry, you know, cutting trees, milling timber, but doing it in a way that would perpetuate the forest forever. In fact, making the Menominee people foresters instead of farmers. And that's what they did. The United States government, I think, eventually came to recognize that this was a good thing for the land base that the Menominee had. And they were also, I think, really trying to understand how sustainable forestry could happen in the United States. This is late 1800s, early 1900s. And the Menominee having that long ecological understanding of the landscape, having a vision that they could actually harvest trees while maintaining the forest, that was a logical place for the government to kind of learn about some of that. And we're still learning today from the Menominee.
It's just such a dramatic example of what you call indigenous models of sustainability. Can you talk about that phrase a little bit?
Yeah, I think I first started thinking about that at the College of Menominee Nation. And they were thinking about it for quite a long time within that college, tribal college framework. And the idea was, this is probably it's in the mid-90s, I would say. They were starting to think about sustainability. We were seeing sustainability kind of come onto the scene internationally. The UN, you had the meeting down in Rio. And people were thinking, well, what is sustainability and how do we understand it? At the college there, they kind of wanted to start thinking about, well, how did we do this? How did sustainability come to be here on the Menominee Reservation? Particularly when you look at right to the north is national forest land, right? That land looks very different. So the question is how and why? And even more so that because it's a college and they're interested in learning and thinking about applying lessons to other spheres of life, I guess. So how do we understand sustainability in a way that goes beyond our forestry? How do we understand sustainability in a way that other communities can take it, what we've learned, and apply it in their situation? Because the goal is sustainability for all of us, all right? Not just sustainability for one piece of the planet, but really to kind of change our frameworks. And what the College of Menominee Nation came up with was this very elegant theoretical model of sustainability that I think encompasses more culture and human capabilities than our other sort of models of sustainability. We talk about the three-legged stool, right? We've got environment, economy, and sociology, or the social sphere. And I can give talks on that. Most people are falling asleep by the end of it. Right. Sustainability is really hard to conceive of. It's pretty easy to talk about ecology. You know, that's a scientific field. We have people that study all sorts of different aspects of it. Economy, we have that. We have economists. They can understand that. But then there's this thing called like social, or what is that?
I've been wondering the same thing.
It's broad.
It's huge. It's huge, right? To put it off in its own category like that. What is that? What does that mean when it's separate from economy is one of the things I think about a lot.
Yeah. And so this theoretical model that came out of the Menominee experience at their tribal college, really, it separates that into six different dimensions. And each one of those really has human beings as a part of it. So even though there's one of the dimensions is called natural environment, that includes human beings. That's something that we don't really see in ecology in the same way. Many indigenous people look at the world, look at other species, look at ecosystems as relatives, as sacred gifts. And we have responsibilities as human beings to those other relatives, those other beings. And this model is a way to sort of capture that idea. And I think a lot of us, you know, even non-native people have very deep, oftentimes have deep spiritual connections to the world, natural world, but it's not incorporated into how we think about sustainability. It's not incorporated in how we do science, certainly not incorporated into how we do the economics. And this is a model that incorporates that into every sort of piece of it. Now, I always ask people, you know, if you're thinking about sustainability and you really take it to heart that human beings are part of that equation, that we want to be sustaining not just ecosystems, but human communities. And I think we can all agree that that's part of sustainability writ large. Where does culture fit in?
Right.
If we're not sustaining culture, if we're not teaching our children, if we're not learning from our elders, if we're not learning from each other, that cultural piece of sustainability sort of falls by the wayside. When a university, for example, builds a building and they have the LEED standards and they have the green roof and they have the solar and they have their energy all dialed in, that's great. Where's the culture?
Yeah. Right. And I think in your scale that was developed there at the College of Menominee Nation, it's called Human Perception, Activity, and Behavior. And I thought that was so, so interesting because, again, it's not saying, oh, economy isn't got people in it, right? Mm-hmm. Or environment doesn't have people in it. But there's also different ways to think about how people interact with space and environment and how our culture shapes how we live and what is meaningful and how we're sustained as people, right? So can we run through them just really, really quickly, the six?
Sure. Components? You're giving me the quiz here on the spot. This is good. I like this.
I have a cheat sheet.
College Land podcast here. Everyone's
got to
be on their toes.
Yeah, that's right.
So I'll start at the top of the model. First of all, you can find this paper. We wrote it up so everyone can see it and use it freely at Sustainability Science. And we paid for open access.
Awesome. We'll put it in our show notes so people will find it.
Perfect. So at the top, you have this idea of land and sovereignty. Now that's a very specific thing for American Indian tribes. In the United States, we are sovereign governments. The federal and state governments recognize that. The tribes have been sovereign since before the United States was a country. So that kind of comes there. And then the idea of land and sovereignty is, do you have control over your land and resources? Who's making the decisions? And the idea is that that's a really important part of sustainability, right? If you can make decisions for your community, if you're sovereign, if you have the land, then you can make decisions that lead to sustainability. And now, while this is very specific for American Indian communities, it's also something where I think of outside of that into just, you know, other communities, you know, do you have the power to make decisions on your land? That gives, you know, the first hint that this model is developed from an indigenous experience, yet it is more universal and you can use it. So after land and sovereignty, we have the natural environment. And I already mentioned that includes human beings. Another element, and now I'm going to get off, so I have to count on my fingers here. We have economy. I think for this one, it's really important to start thinking through scale. And so you start using scale to look at household economy, community economy, regional, national, international, and you can start playing with that. Another piece of another dimension is technology. Now, technology can be something like for the Menominee, they have modern geographic information systems, the GIS, mapping, satellite imagery, all that. Modern forestry inventories, they're using that to manage their forests. But it can also be traditional technologies. Now, how do we harvest maple sugar? How do we build canoes to harvest wild rice? Now, how do we process that rice? Those are all technologies that are traditional technologies. So you can kind of see how culture comes into play as well as maintaining our sort of modern existence on the same playing field as our cultural values, beliefs, and traditions. Let's see, I have four there. You mentioned human activity, perception, and behavior. This one too, it can be individual. You can start thinking, why do I see things this way? Why do I recycle when maybe my neighbor doesn't? What are my ways of seeing the world? How does my experience and knowledge play into that? Let's see, which one did I forget?
Institutions.
Institutions, that was one of my favorites, and I almost forgot it. Yeah, that's the same as we have our modern institutions. For example, the tribal college, that's a modern institution or a modern tribal government. But we also have our traditional institutions, could be our clan systems, for example. And those clan systems have a lot of knowledge built within them. So that's you can kind of see that I'm pulling cultural elements into each one of these. And then, did I get six?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
And A then, plus. Then,
yeah, okay, great. Thank you. I'll give myself a C plus here. But then the question is, okay, so sustainability, sustainable development, and it contains these six elements. Well, that doesn't really get us there. So this model goes further and says, what sustainability really is a process of recognizing the inherent tensions within each one of those dimensions and amongst those dimensions. And not only a process of recognizing them, but trying to relieve those tensions. All the while understanding that this is something that will ebb and flow over time. It's dynamic. So a tension might arise between, let's just say, clear cutting and human perception. That's a pretty common one in the forestry realm. Clear cutting doesn't look nice, yet it fulfills an ecological sort of niche. There's a tension there. Well, once that tension is relieved, that's tending towards sustainability, but that tension can always come back. And it's a never-ending process. You never get sustainable. It's always a process working towards that.
Well, I love this, partly because I imagine sitting down with people and talking about balancing these different components with the goal of understanding what the tensions are and relieving them, as opposed to debating who's right and who's wrong or what best practices are. It seems like a really different kind of process, and one that would be community building in and of itself, we're kind of a nurturing process. So I really love it, and I find it really inspiring to try to think about systems this way. And I think I love it the most that it came out of, Menominee folks trying to come up with, how did we do this? How did this work for us? It's like the theory comes after the practice has already proven itself.
Yeah. And you hit the nail on the head in terms of how useful this is, right? You don't have to be arguing about things. You have your own truth, your own perceptions. Again, we can look at the model, your own perceptions and kind of how you see the world. And we can talk about them using this model as a framework. Then we can have your ideas, my ideas, we can put them together, and it can all be layered in a narrative that makes sense to many, many people in a way that I don't think debates alone can do. And I think equally, we start learning about each other as people, that I understand where you're coming from a little bit better, listening to your own narrative, you understand where I'm coming from, and we can sort of understand where those tensions lie and then say, well, the tension isn't the main part. It's how do we resolve that? And the final little piece of the model, and I say little, but that's it's not really little. It's very profound. It's the question is, so how have the Menominee relieved these tensions in the past and in the present? How are they relieving these tensions? And that gets to Menominee's profound tie to the land. In the model, we say autochthony, Menominee autochthony. And that's a word that it has a negative context in some international arenas, but the way it's used here is really that the Menominee's tie to the place. They are in their traditional territories. They are in the space where they essentially had their origin story. Unlike my tribe, the Potawatomi, we migrated from the eastern part of the United States. Menominee have no migration story. They are from where they are. They're called the ancient ones, or the ones that have been there, right? And so this idea of tie to the place, tie to the land, is helping them balance those tensions and making decisions. And the model outside of the Menominee community really relies on individuals and people trying to understand, what is your value? What are your values around sustainability, and how can you use that value to promote sustainability?
Yeah, well, if I can just kind of draw us back to that one component of institutions, and you mentioned universities as one of those institutions, and I guess I just want to dwell on for a moment the significance of the College of Menominee Nation being there, right? And what kind of resource that is, and it hasn't been there for a super long time, right? I dug into this a little bit and found that the tribal colleges and universities really emerged since the 1960s when tribes started doing, kind of self-determination campaigns, and College of Menominee Nation was founded in 1993. So this is a really important, it seems I'm getting a feel for it, at least how important that institution is in supporting the forestry and vice versa, probably.
Yeah, the tribal colleges across the board are really, really important parts of tribal community. And you're right, it's part of self-determination, it's part of sovereignty, if we think about that model again. And it helps the tribes be able to engage in higher education, but make sure that cultural values are included. Before the tribal colleges were established, and I even think some now, but major land grant universities, the big state universities, were not always friendly to American Indians, right? Educational systems as a whole, when you look at the history of boarding schools, stealing children,
Right.
forcing them to change their language, forcing them to learn things that, a lot of the boarding school also was trying to make people farmers, right? We had the
Right.
farming. And so that legacy really created a problem for American Indians, and you can see that educational disparity to this day. Well, the tribal colleges evolved, and I think out of a recognition that we are sovereign entities, we are sovereign tribes, we are sovereign governments, we can teach our own people how to, teach things that are important for our society. And in this case, the sustainability model is one of the things that College of Menominee Nation teaches. And in fact, the curriculum is built around this model. So every student learns about this model, talks about it, and debates it, and incorporates it into what they're doing. Now, one of the things that also is important is that tribal colleges are still fighting to, let's just say, get parity with the
Right.
other land grant universities. So the tribal colleges are were added to the land grant universities, but the funding and the resources that go to them are not as they're not equitable. Let's just put it that way, when you compare them to the large state land grant universities. And we're trying to change that. And I think once people recognize the wonderful scholarship and education that comes out of the tribal colleges, we will see more and more funding for expanding these programs, because it really does help us. As you see with that model, it helps us all learn, and it will get us to a better place in our society.
Yeah, that you've made a very convincing sort of description of this or argument for this. So you had that immersion and that time working for the US Forest Service in conjunction with the Menominee Nation and the College of Menominee Nation, but then you moved to the settler university, right? You moved to University of Minnesota. And so you have a pretty, I think a unique opportunity, to kind of reflect on both. And I'm wondering, what should the big land grant universities be doing for Native students, for tribes?
Yeah, this is a huge question. I think we need to take the land grab university reporting very, very seriously and engage in deep discussions on how do we maintain or how do we use the endowment money and land in order to benefit Native people, Native students in this case at the universities. And that's a hard discussion, but we have to start there. And say, how are we using this to benefit Native people? Because really, I like to read the comments in the newspaper. And whenever there's some sort of tribal article here, you'll see a lot of comments like, I didn't take anybody's land, I shouldn't have to pay for that. And in some ways it's true, right? You might be three or four generations out from the original homestead or the farm that was carved out of native lands. And so it's really, it's kind of difficult to draw that straight line. And it is gray. I mean, there's a gray area there, right? But not with these universities. They still have that money from those land sales in their endowments. The universities still have some of that land. And it's not difficult to draw that straight line. It's still active today. That harm is still continuing. The lands that were taken from tribes were often under duress and coercion. Some of it was stolen. And so to understand that history and the fact that the land and the money is still there in the university coffers gives us a unique opportunity to have discussions of how do we make this right?
Yeah.
It's not the fourth generation farmer. I mean, we all need to talk about that as well. And that's an important issue, but it's the line isn't as straight. You don't expect somebody to say, well, here, I'll give you my farm back, because you weren't the one that necessarily even, your family might not have even been here on this continent yet, right? But the universities, again, still have it. And so where there are lands, we need those discussions. Where there is money, which there is at all the universities that are land grants, how are we using that?
Right. And as you say, there's just a very significant need to redress some long-term inequities for Native students to recruit and support Native students, and also, you know, American Indian Studies and, you know, other, you know, student centers. I mean, what kinds of things would you like to see to support a more, you know, just place for Native students on campus?
Yeah, we need a few things. We need, I think, and this is, you can start thinking about all these things cost money, but let's start thinking about how those lands and funds in the endowment that came from Indian lands could be used to address some of these things. So I think we need to be funding more Native faculty. So getting more Native faculty on staff, providing research funds for those faculty members and their grad students. You know, I come in and I have, I don't know, let's just say six grad students, and most of them, five of them are Native, right? They're coming to study with me. I'm not doing anything really special aside from the fact that I understand their reality.
Yep.
They don't have to explain to me what these lands were, where we're standing. I know that. We can start from the same place and move forward with our research and scholarship. And so by hiring faculty, you will, and giving them money to hire grad students, you'll see that increase. And so now we're increasing diversity. We're improving science, developing better solutions to our problems. Another thing I think that we should be doing, in some cases, universities manage or have land that tribes actively want back.
Mm-hmm.
And so getting in discussions about returning land. And it's not just, I think, a matter of saying, here's the land back, let's call it a day. But no, let's see how we can use those lands in a way, or partner in a way, that supports sustainable education, sustainable culture, sustainable science happening on those lands. That's another one.
Great.
I think developing Native centers of, you know, indigenous thought on campus that will help us transform the academy into something that's reaching beyond where we are. I think we can all agree we haven't developed, or we don't have all the solutions for our problems. And we're looking for ways to solve these integrated problems with the economy, with our society, with the ecology in the world. And I think Native people have a lot to offer. And if we had Native centers of academics / research / culture on campus that were strong and integrated, we would start seeing the universities themselves transform in a way that really makes the 21st century science and our 21st century solutions really, really strong and powerful.
Wow. I can't even tell you how much I love that idea of native centers of knowledge. That is brilliant. And just, I feel like mind expanding just to imagine that. So thank you so much for that. I did want to ask you about one new project with the tribes, because another thing that people are talking about a lot is trying to redress some of the things that happened at universities and still happen in kind of exploitative relationships to tribal resources and in relationship to the tribes. And how do we create new research relationships? And so I'm really struck by, and I'm going to try to say this in Ojibwe. I've been working on this, so. Kawegada na na gadawin damin manomin. How
Excellent.
did
That's just as good as I do. Excellent. Nice work.
So, which means first we must consider manomin or wild rice. And this is a super interesting interdisciplinary project that's centered at the University of Minnesota. And I wonder if you could just describe this project a little bit.
Yeah. The University of Minnesota has a complicated relationship with wild rice. There was and is continuing some breeding for cultivated wild rice. If you go to the store, you'll see two different kinds of wild rice. One will be, it'll say something like cultivated paddy rice or cultivated wild rice. And each state kind of has a different law on how they describe that. And then there's natural wild rice. Well, the cultivated stuff came out of the University of Minnesota, and many tribes have been against that. One, this is an economic issue for tribes to be able to sell natural wild rice. You can see the price difference. One is probably, I don't know, $16, $17 a pound. The other one might be, I don't know, four or five. And so there's an economic thing. But the heart of it is this idea that wild rice is a sacred relative for the Anishinaabe people, like Potawatomi, Ojibwe, Odawa people. That's our, I mentioned our migration story earlier. The migration was to come to where the food grows on the water. And so directly this ecosystem with that wild rice growing on the water, that's the reason we're here. And so having a university sort of transform that sacred relative, that core cultural component of our lives into something that's bred, used for economics for the most part. That's been highly offensive, that the tribes haven't wanted that. And the University of Minnesota started about 10, 15 years ago to have meetings with the tribes to sort of address this and understand what the tribal perspectives were. And out of this comes the idea that the tribes really would like to work with scientists and universities. You know, we have a lot of staff, we have resources, we have funding, we can get grants, that kind of thing. But not to do the cultivated work, but to start thinking about the natural stands. How does climate change impact the natural wild rice? How does changes in development along the shoreline, etc.? So we started taught, we being a team of us at the university, started meeting with the tribal partners in the state and then region. To basically say, we're here to listen. We have a hydrologist, we have water chemistry, we have an aquatic ecologist, we have some social scientists, we have me who works on building partnerships with tribes and thinking about integrating traditional knowledge into what we're doing. These are our skills. What are your concerns? Would you like to work with us? Let's talk about your issues. And so out of that comes this project. First, we must consider Manoman as a tribally led research project. So we're not saying, oh, let's answer this question because I'm a scientist and I think that question's cool. No, we're asking, well, what do you think is going on here and what should we study? And the end goal is to protect wild rice, natural wild rice where it is, and to understand the systems such that we can restore wild rice, where either it's gone away or it's declining. And we see it in Michigan, where Potawatomi, my family is from kind of lower Michigan there, around the southern part of Lake Michigan. The wild rice is very sparse there. Wisconsin, it's declining. And Minnesota, it's still kind of hanging in there, but there's a concern that it's going to decline. So this project is really about building partnerships so that we can protect and restore wild rice.
I'm really, I find it very, you know, significant that you talk about listening. There's a listening to the people who have that connection to wild rice and putting their concerns at the front of the scientific agenda. So it's not really the University of Minnesota researchers who are, they're writing the grants, I'm sure, but they're not necessarily creating the research question.
Yeah. And to get back to one of the earlier questions about sort of equity and how do we redress some of this exploitation that happened to establish our universities, we're writing in our tribal partners in every grant. They're part and parcel of the research. So if we're going to get water sensors, you know, we're making sure that the water sensors, you know, go to the tribes as well. We're making sure that they are have the ability, if they don't already, they have very capable natural resource programs, but if they don't exactly know how to use a certain sensor, you know, we're teaching them, we're basically giving them the opportunity to do this work themselves, and we're standing with them. So it's been an amazing partnership, and it's hard because you don't have unlimited people, you don't have unlimited resources, but I think is that together we can do a lot more than we can do individually. And really this program that we have, this First We Must Consider Monoman project, is a testament to how wonderful partnerships can be to learning new things about the world, integrating different knowledge systems, and being good neighbors.
Well, that's super inspiring, and I just really appreciate your insight on that and the work that you're doing. Very important stuff. I guess just to end, I wonder if you have any advice that you would like to give to the native student who might be listening to this podcast.
Oh, I would give advice. Reach out to faculty members, reach out to people like myself, other native people on campus, reach out to the non-native faculty members, and tell them who you are and what you're interested in. That's my number one thing. Faculty members, most of us see ourselves as, you know, here for you as a student. We want to hear your ideas and we want to find opportunities to work with you. So reach out to your, you know, your friends and community members as well, so that what you're doing is grounded in where you come from. And it's grounded in something that will help support your community moving forward. And I know that's why Native students go to the university. That's, if you look at the research, if you talk to Native students, they're not here for themselves. They're here for their community. And that's the same thing in our project. We're not here for ourselves. We're here for the tribal community.
Well, that's a beautiful place to end. So thank you so much, Michael Dockery, for your time and your work and for spending time in College Land.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Wow, Nan, that interview really made me think about so much so differently, to consider what it would actually mean to take Indigenous ways of knowing and thinking and research and make them more central to the project of the university as a whole. Really requires us to really change so much about how we understand the project of the university.
Yeah, I mean, that was a real standout moment for me as well. I have thought a lot about Native American studies, which is super important and should be amplified, but that's really studies about Indigenous people. But if we think about Indigenous knowledge about basically everything, like Indigenous economists, Indigenous foresters, like Mike, I think that it's just, it really is an inspiring thought. And why don't we have that? You know, when Mike talks about the money issue, I think that universities do need to step up and they need to think about how can we serve Indigenous students better and how do we get more Native students on campus and how do we support their education better? Absolutely. First and foremost, but it's also something that should be seen as beneficial for everybody. I really got a view for how we all gain if that reckoning at the level of the pocketbook really happens.
And I mean, that reckoning really is not a small thing, right? I mean, we are talking about a lot of money that was stolen. And we're talking about these huge endowments, or very large endowments, in many of these universities that are there because of the native lands and the selling off of them.
And I've got to admit that the whole land grab university, that's a real difference for me from the way that I grew up hearing about land grant universities, which were really celebrated in my family. My dad went to the University of Minnesota, and I always learned that land grant universities were this thing that made the American higher education system democratic, right? So, you know, I've always been taught that I have access to college and to graduate education because of the land grant system. So that says to me that the responsibility is on me, really, to step up and not just allow the burden of making these claims to fall to Native people.
Now, dear listeners, it's time for Report Card, in which we give grades to things happening in the world of higher education. This week's Report Card is about the women's NCAA basketball tournament, which concluded on Sunday. Now, we know there's a lot of problems with the NCAA, which we will be delving into on College Land. But today, we really want to acknowledge and highlight the efforts of the women athletes.
You may have seen some of the posts, because at the beginning of the tournament, women's basketball players used social media to draw attention to their terrible training facilities. They posted photos of the men's well-outfitted weight room next to photos of their totally inadequate weight room, which contained a single set of dumbbells and a few yoga mats. And their TikTok posts and Instagram posts went viral. And I lost a little bit of time there this week. And the NCAA was soon apologizing and trying to figure out how they were going to control the damage.
You know, not only are the women players doing great work drawing attention to these inequities that they face, but the women's tournament itself was fabulous. I stayed up until midnight watching the semifinals on Saturday, and I don't typically stay up until midnight. And first there was the Stanford South Carolina game, and it was so close, and the end was so exciting and just absolutely heartbreaking for South Carolina. And then there was Arizona's upset over UConn, which was also like such an exciting game. And then I watched the finals on Sunday. Like, that also didn't disappoint. Stanford narrowly won a really close game. It was another super exciting finish. And so, I mean, the basketball itself.
Women's basketball, it's such an exciting game. I prefer it to men's basketball personally, because it's a strategy game. And, you know, Lisa and I have both actually lived in North Carolina. And if you live in North Carolina for more than 5 weeks, you're forced to watch basketball until you like it. And that happened to me. But anyway, women's basketball as a sport is just so exciting.
It's really hard to give a grade to this event for our report card, because there is, I mean, let's face it, a lot that's wrong with college sports right now.
So how about if we just grade the players instead? A group work. Group grade.
Oh, that's great. That is such a good idea. Okay, so for the women athletes, the women basketball players, we're going to give them a collective A.
So that's it for today from College Land. If you like what you've heard, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have ideas for us, please send us a message at collegelandpod@gmail.com or on Facebook or on Twitter @collegelandpod.
Thanks to our producer, the wonderful Rochelle Wilson, and to Wisconsin Humanities for their support.
See you next time on College Land.